Going Linux, episode 176, Computer America, number 51. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Computer America.
You're listening to Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show. Computer America is heard coast to coast and around the world. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
Tonight, it's all about Linux. Of course, Linux is an operating system that continues to become more and more popular and more important. It is an important operating system. So every month, we devote an entire Computer America Show to the subject of Linux. How about that? I mean, you know, look. And if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Now, joining us is our resident Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Hey, Larry, welcome to Computer America. How are you?
I am great. I'm very excited about tonight's episode. We're going to do something a little bit different.
We are.
We're going to talk about some things that will start us off with an email, which I don't think we've done before. And we'll discuss, can a lightweight netbook run a 64-bit operating system? And the subtitle is Windows 7 Starter versus 64-bit Linux, an unfair comparison.
Ah, interesting. So let's get started. Again, the topic that you can a lightweight netbook run a 64-bit operating system, subtitled by Windows 7 Starter versus 64-bit Linux, an unfair comparison. Why don't you take it, Larry?
Sure. Well, let me set it up before we get into the email itself.
Yeah.
So I received an email this week from Brian in New Zealand, and we'll read his email as kind of an introduction to the topic here. Mm-hmm. But you might think that when I say that Windows 7 Starter and 64-bit Linux would as an unfair comparison, the 64-bit Linux would have the advantage because it's 64-bit, uh-huh. It is a modern operating system, it's full-featured, mm-hmm. and Windows 7 Starter isn't such a powerhouse. But think about the fact that this is on a netbook now, so you might think that a lighter weight or presumably lightweight operating system would have the advantage on a netbook over a 64-bit full-featured Linux operating system. So with that, I know we are probably in the first segment before the break not going to get through all of Brian's email, but Brian is actually in his email talking about his experience as an experienced Linux user and his experiences in putting a 64-bit version of Linux onto a netbook and comparing it with the out-of-the-box Windows 7 Starter that came on it.
Okay.
So any thoughts or questions or comments before I dive into the email?
No, I say go for it.
Okay. It sounds like a very interesting challenge. So
right.
Brian's email reads, greetings from a listener in New Zealand. I'm in personal observations, I found Linux users typically to be far more knowledgeable about computers in general than their Windows or Apple counterparts. An open source operating system allows one to dismantle the parts and learn from the way the pieces work and interact, much like the way in which one can dismantle an engine and study its workings. Windows, on the other hand, is diametrically the opposite. In fact, what should be very capable hardware becomes limited by Windows, both by Windows the software and by Windows the mentality.
Uh-huh.
As an example, you might laugh, but that'll just prove that my point, as you'll learn later. I write this email on a netbook, an HP with a 1.6 gigahertz dual core Atom CPU that came with an OS pre-installed. Yeah, Windows Starter. Needless to say, Windows Starter was a non-starter. So much for the name. In fact, it got wiped and replaced by Linux Mint 10. The only thing that didn't work immediately was Wi-Fi, but in 5 minutes on a wired connection, that problem was resolved by Mint itself. If you laughed earlier, the real joke is that I was expected to own and tolerate this netbook if I had agreed to HP's and Microsoft's EULA. I'll now tell you that I discovered as I began making comparisons with this netbook. I'll now tell you what I discovered as I began making comparisons with this netbook. As I said, this is Linux Mint 10, and it's 64-bit. Retailers keep on telling me a netbook cannot run a 64-bit operating system, but this netbook proves them wrong. So we'll continue on with the balance of this after the break, of course.
All right, we'll do that. And we're going to start with – that's Windows Mentality Point 1, by the
way. Point number one, yeah.
All right, we'll continue with the point number two. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. It's our all Linux show, everything you want to know about Linux and more. We'll continue on with the email from Brian in New Zealand. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Twenty-two minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show. We are in the middle of our Linux show with Larry Bushy, and you are reading the opening email from Brian. We're doing things a little bit differently, but you had your reasons, and so why don't we continue on with that email?
Sure, absolutely. And we left off with Brian telling us that he was a little miffed, maybe, that he was going to have to use Windows 7 Starter on his netbook until he was told by retailers that a netbook can't run a 64-bit operating system. But to prove them wrong, he installed Linux Mint 10 64-bit on his netbook. So he said that's Windows Mentality Point 1. Windows Mentality Point number two is that on the same hardware, when running Windows Starter, over two-thirds of the available 1 gigabyte of RAM is already consumed by the operating system. Plus, the on-disk page file that Windows uses is already consuming more disk space than the installed RAM in size, 1.2 gigabytes, in fact. And this is even before opening a program. It's like having a large swimming pool to begin with, but Microsoft is draining out most of the water and then saying, there's still enough to swim in, well, paddle perhaps. By comparison, Mint consumes under 18% of the RAM, and the swap partition, equivalent to the page file in Windows, is empty. And I have six desktops and full 3D graphics. Shortly after I purchased the netbook, I swapped the 1 gigabyte of RAM for a maximum for the maximum of 2 gigabytes, and post-boot RAM consumption fell to a measly 8%. And so Brian's experience illustrates to us that although a netbook is sold as a lightweight computer that, well, you shouldn't really install Windows 7 on. It really can't handle it, let alone a 64-bit version of Windows. You, at least in Brian's experience, can install a 64-bit Linux operating system and have it run much more efficiently, apparently, than even Windows Starter can do. And, of course, you're running a full-fledged version of an operating system, not a a limited version that Windows 7 Starter Edition tends to be. I don't know about Windows 7 Starter, but when I tried out Windows XP Starter, it wouldn't even let you change the wallpaper.
Wow. Okay. All right. So
the entire time you're reading that, I was listening to, you know, kind of the specs of it, and it got me kind of, you know, But then I realized you were saying netbook and not ultrabook. For some reason, I had ultrabook on my brain, and then you were saying, you know, maximum 2 gigs of RAM and a 1.6 dual core processor. I'm like, that's pretty low for an ultrabook, but now I can see why, you know, something like Mint would be a lot better than Windows, because no one I think ever has, you know, said Windows is pretty lightweight. I mean, Windows is probably one of the heaviest operating systems out there.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. Even Windows Starter Edition is pretty heavyweight, and although they've tried to slim it down to make it work on a netbook, it's still not all that efficient on that limited hardware, that's for sure. And it illustrates the point that with Linux, even a 64-bit operating system, a 64-bit version of the operating system, can run on very lightweight, modern computers like a netbook or even an ultrabook, and some of those ultrabooks have some really fast processors as well. So I'm kind of itching to get my hands on one and try out Linux and see how it runs.
Yeah. And when you think you're going to do that soon? Or?
Oh, I don't know. I've got to get some money in the bank account first. And
okay.
Podcasting doesn't pay a lot. So.
There you go.
So the purpose in me bringing this to light is simply to start a discussion about Linux and its lightweight nature on computers. And we've talked about this in the past before, but yeah, usually from the perspective of bringing older hardware back to life. But there are plenty of newer netbooks out there and ultrabooks that are lighter weight specs in processor and RAM than your full-fledged desktop, for example, or even a laptop. And Linux is an excellent choice for people wanting to get things done on a netbook, because a netbook is really light and easy to carry around. It's certainly easier and, for people who carry purses, for example, it's easy to slip one in a purse and carry it around with you, as opposed to a full-size 17-inch or even a 15-inch laptop. And it's just that much more portable, that much lighter, and easy to carry around on airplane trips and things like that, business trips. And why saddle yourself with an operating system that doesn't get things done when you can install something that is modern, full-featured, has all of the software that you would need for basic computing already installed by default when you install the operating system, and get yourself in a position where you can use something like a netbook and get it done. One of the folks in the chat room was saying that they have a netbook and really don't like it much and don't want to use it. So you might want to try installing Linux on there and see what you think.
Okay. All right.
I hadn't heard the term netbook in a while. You know, ever since tablets came out, I thought, you know, they were kind of trying to take up the same space, and tablets were obviously, you know, taking over that space. So that's probably one of the reasons why I didn't hear the word netbook before. But I guess just having a full-fledged operating system on something as small as a tablet is probably desirable to most people, even though you don't hear about netbooks much anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And tablet computers typically are running Android as opposed to a full distribution of Linux, although Android you could consider a distribution of Linux because it's running on a Linux kernel, although many people don't know that. But the tablet is a little bit of a different animal, and there has been a tablet actually recently introduced by the folks that are behind KDE, one of the desktops that is available for Linux. And it runs a KDE-based Linux operating system instead of Android.
All right. Now, when we come back, we're going to go back to the topic itself. We're going to stay with that, and we're going to save the other part of Brian's email for the second hour, correct?
Yep.
All right. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. Larry Bushy is here with us. It's our All Linux Show. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Welcome back to our All Linux Show. We're talking about different distributions and how much layer weight there. Can I go back, you know, to the topic? You know, you read the whole quote, can a lightweight netbook run a 64-bit operating system? And then, I'm sorry if I'm making you backtrack a little bit, but maybe I missed it. Windows 7 starter and 64-bit Linux, an unfair comparison. What makes that an unfair comparison?
Well, just the fact that you would think that Windows 7 Starter, because it's designed to work on the netbook, would have an advantage over 64-bit Linux, but it's really the other way around. 64-bit Linux has an advantage over Windows 7 Starter because Windows 7, even the Starter Edition, isn't as lightweight as you would think it is, and 64-bit Linux isn't as heavyweight as you would think a full-featured 64-bit operating system would be. So it's meant to be a little bit of a twist in the plot, if you will.
Okay, so it's fair. So it's fair to compare them. It's just unfair with the results because, you know, one blows the other one out of the water.
Exactly.
There.
Exactly,
okay. Right. Okay. I know Craig kind of left off with, you know, we'll get back to the topic, but I completely forgot where we were on said topic. So.
Okay, we'll turn it back to Larry. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, we'll turn it back over to you because we.
Oh, all right. Fair enough. So we talked a little bit about the two operating systems, and just as we left off, we started to talk about tablets, and maybe we can just branch off into that for a second. I mentioned that the folks behind KDE, one of the desktops that's available for Linux, and just for those new listeners, Linux, unlike Windows and Mac, has multiple desktop options that you can choose to put on your computer. And that's one of the reasons why there are so many different distributions, because each one packages itself with different desktops, different applications, and other different things about the operating system itself. But the tablet that I'm talking about is one that doesn't run Windows. It doesn't run Android. It doesn't run iOS. It runs a version of Linux that has a desktop component to it that is almost identical to the desktop component that's run on many Linux distributions that run on a laptop or a netbook or a desktop computer for that matter. And that is KDE. It stands for the K desktop environment. And the tablet I'm talking about is called the Vivaldi tablet. And I've included a link in the show notes to the Vivaldi tablet. It is a hardware device, a tablet that comes with a full Linux-based operating system running KDE, and KDE's Plasma Active is what they call it. And it's a very nice, from what I'm told, I haven't tried it myself, but it's a very nicely designed from the screenshots and from what I'm told about it, tablet that runs Linux, full Linux, as opposed to Android or something that might be thought of as a more scaled down version of an operating system based on the Linux kernel.
Even though it's a full desktop environment, it's still all touch sensitive, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the point of the tablet, is that it is touch sensitive. One of the things that I tried several years ago, probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, is I had a very early tablet computer. You know, the ones that was a laptop with the screen that spun around and then laid flat. And I tried Linux on that at the time. And to my amazement, the touch screen worked. I didn't expect it to work with Linux on it. I decided that I happened to have one of these devices for work, and it had, you know, a touch version of Windows XP, I think it was, that work provided for me. And I thought, well, let me just try Linux on this device and see how it works. And when I touched the screen, to my amazement, it actually worked. And that was several years ago. They've had several years to perfect it, and they've done a really good job, both the folks over at Google with Android and the KDE folks getting a more modern version of their KDE desktop to work on a full-fledged tablet device these days.
Yeah, I'm thinking a look at that. They only have like a silhouette of the tablet itself, but you can they're kind of showing you the side of it, you know, or is it the bottom of it? It looks kind of cool, but it has some fairly impressive specifications here.
Yeah, exactly. It's a 7-inch, so it's not one of the 10.1 or larger ones that you can get from Samsung with Android on them, but it's a nice 7-inch, nice portable size, 1 gigahertz ARM processor. It comes with a gigabyte of RAM and 8 gigabytes of flash disk available as well. So it's much like those netbooks that we were just talking about. It has 802.11b and G wireless.
Yeah.
1.3 megapixel camera, as many of the tablets come with.
It's a
front, an HDMI output.
It's a front-facing camera too, I see, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I hadn't read that, but if you say so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there it is right there, front-facing camera.
Yeah.
It has two USB ports, a micro SD card slot, an audio jack, as you would expect, hardware volume and power buttons, four-dimensional G sensor. Okay, dimensions.
That's like the – well, I guess basically it's a it has its – like the iPhone, the 4 and the 4S have, it's got what are they called? Gyroscopes.
Oh, yeah, gyroscope.
Yeah, but so there's up, down, left, and right, and
forward and back.
Time? Oh, forward and back. Okay.
It
changes over time.
Yes, it does.
Okay, and you know, a decent battery, and it says here 355 grams. I can't do the math in my head. I don't know what that is, but it's lightweight, and so for a tablet, that's a lot of inputs and outputs. I mean, you don't find too many tablets with an HDMI output and two USB ports and a micro SD card slot. If this is really a netbook in a tablet form factor.
355 grams is 0.7826410 pounds. So about
Google.
0.8. But actually, I have a little app that does that here. It's
0.8. Oh, nice.
0.8, not quite a pound, 0.8 tenths of a pound.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah, so about a quarter of what a regular laptop might be. Well, maybe even...
Yeah,
you know, some of the lighter weight laptops are 4 pounds or so.
I like the fact that it has an HDMI 1080p output.
That's amazing to me.
Put that in there, right? Exactly. As you mentioned, 8 gigabytes of NAND flash drive. So this is the Vivaldi tablet, and this is designed specifically to run KDE's.
Desktop.
They say K's desktop environment. Who is K, by the way? I know there's Agent K.
Agent K, yeah. He started working for the Linux group after he finished
Men in Black. Yeah, exactly.
Being one of the Men in Black.
Yeah. Did you like that movie? Because if you do, you'll really like this new one. The three kind of ties it all together and answers a lot of questions. If you're into it, I don't know.
So, I saw the other two. I haven't seen this
one. You should see this
one. I'm going to see it for sure.
You will like it because it ties everything in. All right, so,
I zoned out for like 2 seconds, and we were talking about tablets and Linux, and then all of a sudden we're talking about Men in Black.
You have to be quick.
What term did I miss?
You have to be quick. We're talking about the KDE, the K desktop environment. I asked who K was. I said that's Agent K for Men in Black. So that you missed that.
Okay.
You got to pay attention, or you get lost in this program. You know that.
and the screen that they're showing it, all the little icons. That's exactly what the KDE desktop looks like. The GUI looks like. So.
Yes, and some of the icons have been designed specifically for this tablet, and some of them you'll recognize from the Linux desktop if you have Linux with a KDE desktop on them. And so if you're using a KDE desktop on your notebook computer or on your desktop computer now, you'll feel right at home using this tablet.
Let me ask you this.
Lots of options, that's for sure.
Let me ask you this. The touch interface that you get with a tablet – Windows, that's 8, it's going to be great because it's designed to work with a touch device, really. iOS, obviously, is touch. KDE, when you now use with a touch device, do you find – is it easier to use? Do they have additional gestures that they might incorporate it, or is it just basically a mouse operating system moved over to a tablet and that's it?
No, it's not a mouse operating system moved over to a tablet. They've designed this specifically for the tablet and for a touch interface. I haven't used it myself, but I do know that they've designed it specifically for the touch interface. So I wouldn't expect that it would feel like something that was hobbled together and made to work on a tablet. It's designed to work here, and I'm pretty sure that it's going to work just fine.
All right. Well, listen, we got to take another break here, and then we'll continue on. It is our All Linux show tonight. Everything you want to know about Linux and more, and we're talking about Linux running a 64-bit operating system, and we're talking about Linux running on a tablet. And we're going to continue on with more of this when we come back. Stay with us. This is Computer America. So we are talking about we've finished talking about the Vivaldi tablet. So I think that we pretty much answered the question. I just wanted to ask you with Linux again, what is the latest version of the most popular version of Linux is what? That's the
Most popular version of Linux is Ubuntu.
Yeah, Ubuntu.
It gets a lot of press and is most recognized by people who may not be in the Linux community because they do some advertising. They're sponsored by Canonical. Their latest version is 12.04, and you can their numbering scheme tells you the year and then the month that it was released. Mm-hmm. So 12.04 was April of 2012. Mm-hmm. They release a new release or a new version every 6 months, but every couple of years, one of them is a long-term support release that's supported, in this case, on 12.04 for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the versions in between are not exactly maintenance releases, but they tend to use those in-between long-term support releases as times when they try out new things. Right. So one of those in-betweens, they tried out a new desktop environment. They called it Unity, and it was met with, to put it kindly, mixed reviews.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, we're talking about the tablets and everything, and we're talking about the netbooks, which are kind of fading out. Of course, the big push now are the ultrabooks. That's the thing now. Everybody's coming out with an ultrabook. All the major players, all the big manufacturers, basically saying goodbye to the optical media. More and more people saying you don't really need optical media anymore, and for the few times that you do, you can always hook up a little external drive. But for the most,
I agree with that.
For the most part. And what you get back in return are this incredibly slick, slim-looking product. So now, I assume with Linux that it will run fine on any of these machines using the latest latest processors that we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll run on anything with Intel hardware on it, processors and video cards and sound cards. Intel is one of the big supporters of Linux. So if it's got Intel hardware in it, 99.9% of the time it'll run just fine. And that 0.1% of the time that it doesn't, it's just a matter of downloading the latest updates and it'll work. So the Ultrabooks, I've been looking at some of the reviews of Linux on the Ultrabooks, and some of the Ultrabooks that use some proprietary hardware that isn't supportive of Linux all that much, like some video drivers tend not to support Linux very well, and some wireless network cards don't support Linux too much, but they're few and far between, and provided that you do your research ahead of time, you should be able to find an Ultrabook that will run Linux out of the box without any fuss or muss or bother, and it's only a matter of time before companies like ZA Reason and System 76 that sell computer hardware with Linux pre-packaged on it, pre-installed on it, will have Ultrabooks of their own.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And, of course, all the Linux operating systems now that are available work fine on these Ultrabooks?
Yeah, like I said, if the hardware that they use in the Ultrabook is Linux compatible, and for the most part it will be, yeah. Installing on an Ultrabook is no more difficult and no less pleasurable than installing on any other kind of laptop, except that you, instead of installing it from a CD, you would install it from a thumb drive.
Yeah, and not only that, you're going to see a real boost in speed, too, because Linux already is a faster, leaner, meaner operating system, so on an Ultrabook, I would think it would really be smoking.
Oh, absolutely, and especially with the SSD drives that some of these come with, yeah. And many of them come with, Linux just blazes a trail. It really does. I installed a small size SSD drive on my laptop, mm-hmm. and even on the older hardware, I noticed a little bit of a speed boost with the SSD. Thinking about a hardware that's optimized for the SSD, I can only imagine how much faster it would work.
With an Ultrabook, could I just use the go to the Linux website, download it onto the SSD there, and then install it from the SSD rather than having to copy it to a flash drive?
From the hard drive itself?
Yeah.
Technically, I suppose you could partition it, make yeah. a little partition, and boot from that partition.
Yeah.
It might be a little more difficult to do it that way. I think the more traditional way to do it would be to install it on a thumb drive,
yeah.
Flash drive of
right.
some sort, and just stick that into a USB port and right. boot from that. But now that you mention it, that's probably something I should try.
Yeah, you could download it and then just copy to a flash drive and then reboot and go from
sure.
that point. Yeah, exactly. Okay,
yeah,
but either way, it is something you should probably try, especially now with like becoming so fast and quick. Hey, listen, we got to take a top of the hour break, and then we'll come back with some emails people have written to Larry with Linux questions. Again, our lines stay open at 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. We've got your local and national news, and then back with another hour of Computer America. Stay with us.
ComputerAmerica.com. You got computer problems? Bring them on. You're listening to Computer America. Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us toll-free, 866-606-TALK. That's 866-606-TALK. Or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And we continue on with our good friend and buddy and correspondent, Larry Bushy.
You've been upgraded to buddy. Good for you.
I love that. Thanks.
Of course, Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast, and we continue on this hour, and we move into our email phase of the show. And I know in hour one we had Brian from New Zealand, and we're going to open up with Brian in New Zealand.
Yeah, actually, before we do that, deferring to the chat room, there's a question in the chat room.
Oh, I didn't notice.
About running Microsoft Office on Linux. And Steve in the chat room said he doesn't know an awful lot about Linux, but wanted to know if he can run Microsoft Office applications under Linux, or do they run only under Windows? Technically, they're designed only to run under Windows, much like a proprietary company might do. They're trying to lock you into their operating system by providing an Office suite that works basically on only their operating system. Although they do have a version for the Mac, they don't have a version for Linux, but that doesn't stop Linux folks from running it. There are a couple of ways you can run Microsoft Office on Linux. One would be to run it in Wine. Now, Wine is an interface that sits between a Microsoft Windows application and Linux that does the translation. So the Microsoft program doesn't speak Linux and Linux doesn't speak Microsoft, but Wine sits there and translates back and forth. So you might think you would take a performance hit because it's translating, but in many cases, it is going to run just as quickly. Microsoft products are going to run just as quickly under Wine on Linux as they will on Windows. And so that's one way. You can find Wine, more information about Wine without having to install Linux, at winehq.org. They have a lot of information there. You can download it, but most Linux distributions provide it in their software repositories, so you don't really have to go to the Wine site, other than the fact that they have a nice set of information in their AppDB, their application database, that talks about which programs are working the best, since Microsoft doesn't provide the source code for their products. A lot of what's done with Wine has to be reverse engineered to make it work, and much of that work is done by Linux users. So that's one way to run Microsoft Office on Linux. Another way is to run Windows in a virtual machine, and then run your Microsoft Office products in that Windows. And a virtual machine is something like VirtualBox or VMware, and virtual machines are available for Linux and Mac and Windows as well. And so you can run one operating system inside of another. Of course, that takes up a lot of disk space if all you're really trying to do is run an Office suite on Linux. You're taking up disk space for installing the entire Windows operating system as well as the Office suite as well. And then you still have the issues of viruses and spyware you have to protect yourself against in the virtual machine, so you have to install antivirus software on there to protect yourself there as well. So not really a good option unless you have a lot of other things that you want to run on Windows that aren't Linux compatible.
What about
generally speaking, go ahead.
What about, you know, LibreOffice and things like that? You know,
well, that's kind of where I was going next.
Ah, great minds think alike.
Yeah. So generally speaking, though, you really don't have to run Microsoft's product under Linux, because there are plenty of different Office suites available that are Linux compatible. Most of them are also Windows compatible and certainly don't come with the price tag of Microsoft Office. Nope. I think if you were to buy a full license version of Microsoft Office, make the mistake to go to a store and say, I want to buy Microsoft Office and I can't upgrade because I don't have it on my computer, you'd be paying, what, $300 or $400 for the full professional version. And you might be able to get it for $100 or maybe a less if you've got an upgrade version or a student version or something like that. But what you mentioned, Craig, is LibreOffice. And LibreOffice is no charge. It's a community-supported Office suite that is compatible with Microsoft Office file formats. So it can read .doc files or .xls files, the document and spreadsheet versions of the files from Microsoft Office. And in fact, it can even read the latest version of Microsoft's Office suite file formats, which are XML-based file formats, the .docx and .xlsx, and even the PowerPoint, the PPTX, I think it is, versions of the most recent versions of Microsoft's Office suite are you can view them and edit them and save them back to those formats, so you can exchange information with somebody who has Microsoft Office installed on their Windows machine. Or you can just install LibreOffice or its older brother, OpenOffice, which is now run by the Apache Foundation. It was originally OpenOffice wasn't invented by Sun Microsystems, but it was adopted by Sun Microsystems. It was taken over by them. And then when Oracle purchased Sun, Oracle took OpenOffice for a little while, and the open source community wasn't sure whether or not it was going to stay open source. So they made a fork of that, a new branch of that, and called it LibreOffice. And so that is the latest version of Office suites that are Windows, Mac, and Linux compatible, that are also compatible with the file formats from Microsoft Office.
Okay, well, hopefully that answers Steve's question, and you get a lot to think about. We got another question in the chat room from Big Tone. I don't know if you noticed that he's saying that basically he has a computer. I guess it's from 2008, which is not too old. And right. he says the clock running. He says we're running Linux. Is the clock skips? Free cell is jumpy. Audio cuts out now and then. And when I'm listening to Computer America, he says, and my video is choppy now and then as well. I don't think that's a Linux problem. I think he's got something else going on there.
Yeah, I think so as well. And Big Tone or Tony and I have exchanged a couple of emails on this subject before, and I've suggested possibly the BIOS BIOS battery may be dead. You know, that sure. That could cause the clock to lose time or act up, and it can cause some of the other things as well. You might want to think about other hardware issues too.
I that's something really similar to this, and with my old computer, and it would kind of like, you know, kind of halt for a second every few minutes, or when I was playing a game, you know, every few seconds, and it would cause the clock to be off by, you know, 1 or 2 minutes over a day, you know, and over like a week it'd be off by, you know, like almost half an hour, and it would cause, you know, music to skip, which he was experiencing, mm-hmm. some videos to skip, and I think with that it was either like a bad stick of RAM or something wrong with the processor. I didn't really figure out until I got a new computer, but
that fixed it right there.
it doesn't really answer it, but it definitely sounds like a hardware problem. Nothing wrong with Linux.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. The symptoms are indicative of something with the hardware.
I'm sure he would experience the same thing running Windows. I mean, the same thing.
Yeah.
It's not.
I would think so.
And the idea of a dead battery could cause that. That would probably be one of the first things to check out. And then, of course, the next thing would be run a memory test or like mem test. There are a lot of free ones out there that let you run the computer, you know, for a day or what have you, and then get the and see if because you know memory can be intermittent at best. That could cause it. And another thing that might cause these problems, spooky problems, is a dying power supply, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That could cause these problems as well. You could have a power supply that basically is intermittent or it's dying, and you're getting this. Matter of fact, that would probably be one of the first things that I would check out would be the power supply. Is it Big Tone or Big Tony? Okay.
I don't know.
The username is Big Tone, but he has emailed us before, as and his real life name is Tony.
Okay, so it's got to be Tony. All right, so Big Tony, I would say check your power supply. I think that would be the first thing to go. That might be dying. Get yourself another inexpensive but a good one, power supply, and you might find that a lot of these problems are going away. That would be my suspect. Anyway, hey, we can take a break, and then we'll get back to your emails. This is the Computer America Show. It's all about Linux tonight with Larry Bushy. Stay with us. Twenty-two minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show, 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number, live at ComputerAmerica.com or the chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. Larry Bushy continues on with our All Linux Show tonight, and we're going to go to an email now from Brian in New Zealand again.
No, I think we'll save that one till the end. I don't want to make this the Brian from New Zealand show. So,
okay,
let's move on to Bert, and we'll save Brian's till the end. And if we don't get to it, we'll cover it on the Going Linux podcast.
Okay, that's fine.
All right. So, Bert has a Gone Linux story. We like to include Gone Linux stories because they're stories about people who have Gone Linux, adopted Linux, and used it successfully.
All right.
So Bert sends his greetings saying, hi, L, T, and B. For new listeners, L is Larry, T is Tom, one of my co-hosts, and B is Bill, another one of my co-hosts. We have three co-hosts on the Going Linux podcast.
I thought L was lettuce, T was tomato, and B was bacon.
No, that's B. L.
Okay.
Yeah, we get that too.
Oh, you do. All right. And I thought I was being original. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. All right. Bert says, first, my story in a line or two. I went from interested in Linux from a distance, i.e. reading a few reviews for new releases of the major distributions and other pop tech articles, to Gone Linux in less than 2 weeks back in mid-summer of 2010. I would have tried GNU Linux and most likely made the switch a long time before that, but I'm blind and have needed something that had accessibility software working out of the box, as Linux users are few and far between where I live. So as soon as I heard that Vinix, Linux for the VI or visually impaired, had released a version based on Ubuntu 10.04 Lucid Lynx, I downloaded the ISO image and burned my first live CD. In short, it booted up, came up talking on my old Dell laptop, and to my delight, in spite of some accessibility issues, quickly discovered that Linux was for me. Perhaps sometime I could give a short explanation of the accessibility options that exist for Linux these days. Sadly, there is little publicity regarding Linux for the blind, low vision, and other disabled people. I was checking out a few Linux-related podcasts today that I'd never listened to before, and I must say that you guys do a better job both as far as presentation and content than most of these. Live long and prosper.
There you go. Well,
thanks, Bert, and congratulations on converting to Linux.
There you go. All right. High praise indeed.
Yes. And that just illustrates that there are versions of Linux out there that are specifically designed for one type of person or another, or one application or another. And as Bert observed, Vinix is one that, even when you're installing it, has a screen reader that works right out of the box.
Uh-huh. Okay, there you go.
Okay.
Good to know. All right, well, let's move on to Don, who evidently has success with Debian Linux on something called Raspberry Pi. I just love these names that they come up with, Raspberry Pi. Pi spelled P-I, of course.
All of course. Right. Yes. This is Geekville here. Uh-huh. It's got to be P-I.
Yeah, exactly.
So Don writes, "Dear Larry, Tom, and especially Bill, my name is..."
Especially
well,
Bill.
Especially Bill, because Bill gave him a tip here. We'll find that in a second.
Right.
So my name, my name is, misspelling there, Don. You read my email on episode 174. I was having a problem installing Debian 6 on my laptop computer. This email is a follow-up and clarification of my original email. But first, before I explain, I want to make a comment. Keep Bill on the payroll. He completely solved my problem. All in capital letters. To clarify, in fact, I'm going to give him a raise. I'm going to double his salary from zero to
zero plus.
twice zero.
I get those nightly. So it's about time.
Yeah, there we go. To clarify my original email, one, I have ordered a Raspberry Pi, but it's back ordered for about 2 months. Well, at this point, we have to explain what a Raspberry Pi is.
Yeah,
otherwise it's a credit card-sized computer.
Oh, really? Okay, because a Raspberry Pi after 2 months would be, you know, kind of moldy.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. But no, it's a single-board computer on a credit card-sized PC card.
Wow.
And it has, depending on which of the two models you order, it has network card or wireless or USB ports and so on. So
cool. Very cool.
Let's continue on. Point number two, the Raspberry Pi is a very small ARM-based computer. Point number three, the current recommended operating system for the Raspberry Pi is a port of Debian 6 that runs on the ARM processor. Point four, I wanted to get a feeling for Debian 6 before the Raspberry Pi arrives, so I wanted to install the Intel version of Debian 6 on my laptop. Five, my initial problem was that Debian 6 required non-free firmware to be installed to allow my wireless adapter to work. This was my problem. I could not get Debian 6 to recognize the USB stick that contained the correct firmware. Bill's suggestion was to connect the laptop to a wired Ethernet connection and try installing Debian 6 and just skip the part that asks if you want to install the non-free firmware. Then after the installation, install the non-free firmware.
Uh-huh.
Step, 7, I did what Bill suggested and it worked perfectly. 8, I now have a working version of Debian 6. Thank you so much for solving my problem. I must say that after installing Ubuntu, Linux Mint, and Debian 6, Ubuntu and Linux Mint are light years ahead of Debian in ease of installation. Both Ubuntu and Linux Mint recognize my wireless card and all of my hardware automatically. Thanks again, Don. Mm-hmm. So Debian and the version that he's talking about, version 6, Debian is the version of Linux that Ubuntu and Linux Mint are based on. It's just that Ubuntu and Linux Mint have put some additional development effort around make it easy to install
evidently,
and to use.
Yeah, evidently it worked because obviously you wouldn't have had these trouble with those aforementioned operating systems.
Exactly.
Hey, listen, we're going to continue on. We'll be right back with lots more.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show. We just finished reading off Don's email. And in the chat room, I said something a little earlier about how it's kind of hard to find systems that run Linux Mint right out of the box because, you know, most computers are either installed with Windows or Mac right off the right off the bat. Mm-hmm. You linked to a website that shows... Are these routers or full-fledged computers running Linux Mint right off the start?
Right. They actually are. they look like routers.
They're
the same size as a router. But no, they are from a company that does embedded Linux, embedded computing. So they build small hardware, and they have a couple of nice boxes that the Linux Mint folks have contracted with them to buy to build for them, and they're branded as Mint boxes. So they come pre-installed with Linux Mint. You can order them online from the link that I provided, and they are. Fanless, cool in both senses of the word, little Linux computers, and they don't come with keyboards or mice or displays. You need to add those yourself. And for $300 or $400, they are a relatively inexpensive way to get yourself into a Linux computer that is supported and runs very, very quietly. Makes a nice server, from what I'm told.
They look amazing. You know, they're little tiny things, but they're full blown Linux computers.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, I closed the website again, but I think they have little rabbit ear type things like a wireless router might have.
Yeah.
Makes them look like a router, but no, they're full Linux computers running a full version of Linux Mint.
Now, what processors do they run? Do you know?
I'd have to look. I think they may be ARM processors in there, but again, they're
There's one here, a Radeon and HD 1.65 gigahertz dual core.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's on with a 1 gigahertz dual core.
Right. Yeah, and they've designed them so that you can get to the hard drive and the RAM from a panel underneath, so that you can swap out the hard drive for something bigger or an SSD or add more RAM. Very easy to access those panels.
Ben, you should definitely take that link and put it in our show notes.
I already did it.
Good man. All right.
Look at that.
Yeah, it is.
Right on top of it.
Yeah, right.
That's how I make all my money, just putting links at the right time.
So we have another email from Bert, who wrote back, and he's got some information that might help out Steve, who asked the question about Office Suites and running Microsoft Office under Linux, and we talked about LibreOffice an open office. So Bert has some additional information on those office suites. So Bert writes, to clarify a bit on the OpenOffice LibreOffice story, he's going to give us a little background here. Yes, LibreOffice is indeed a fork of OpenOffice. It was started more or less for the reasons mentioned in the Going Linux podcast show. In the beginning, folks were not happy with Oracle's management of the project, as was more or less mentioned. When LibreOffice was started out, they got a lot of developers on board, and although some felt the group was a bit Eurocentric, they have made it much easier for a new or less experienced developer to get involved with the project. The OpenOffice name, branding, and such were given to the Apache Foundation by Oracle last year, so its open source creds are still very much intact. Possibly because of this, or for whatever reason, over the last few months, IBM and a lot of other people and groups have gotten on board, so OpenOffice development is very much alive and well. I think OpenOffice is more niched for enterprise users, whereas LibreOffice is trying to appeal to the small business and home user as well. They will find they will most likely diverge from one another more with time, but as far as I know, code is free open source in either branch, so a good feature in one is likely to be implemented in the other sooner or later. Just a side note from me. The Apache license actually doesn't allow them to take code from LibreOffice, whereas the other way around. I may have had that right in the first place. Bottom line is Apache can't adopt some of the changes that LibreOffice has made, whereas LibreOffice can adopt all of the changes and improvements that OpenOffice makes, and that's primarily because of the licensing, strange but true, and so they will definitely diverge over time. Continuing with Bert's email, there was quite the cyber soap opera going on for several months during and after the forking, but it seems to have died down, being overshadowed by Google versus Oracle court case and Apple versus everybody versus Google tearful grins. By the way, OpenOffice is now officially called Apache OpenOffice instead of OpenOffice.org. Much easier to pronounce name, for sure. LibreOffice is done by the Open Document Foundation. I'm quite happy with LibreOffice in Ubuntu myself, but I looked at the new features list for the latest OpenOffice released a few weeks ago and saw some good stuff going on there as well. And now a question. Are the latest distributions using LibreOffice 3.4? Ubuntu 12.04, Fedora 16, or is it 17? I don't know. I've yet to give the latest Ubuntu a whirl. In answer to the question, yes, they are. Note, for those who are switching from OpenOffice to LibreOffice or vice versa, you must uninstall one completely to install the other to get things to work anyway. Most, if not all, Linux package managers will enforce this.
Why? Why do they do that?
Documents will automatically be linked to the new Office suite, so get rid of one before trying to install the other. Regards, Bert.
Why? Why do they make you do that?
Primarily because they are essentially based in the same software code, and as a result, the changes that OpenOffice makes in the libraries that it uses to run the software, the libraries will be named the same. And so if there's a slightly newer version of the OpenOffice library that's in there that's named the same and you install LibreOffice, it's going to say, oh, you've got a newer version. But the code won't be the same and they won't work with one another. So you actually have to uninstall one before the other.
Got it.
But like I said, with most Linux distributions, the package manager will make you uninstall one before the other one will install.
Which one do you actually like better, or is that an unfair question? Because they're doing the same thing basically. You just have, some have more features than the other and maybe.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know whether it's unfair or not, but it's tomato-tomato. You know, different flavors of the same thing. Mm-hmm. OpenOffice was the only thing available for a while when Sun had it that had a full suite Office that was integrated and worked together, much like Microsoft Office did. And then there were some improvements made to it that were part of Linux that weren't part of the versions that you could get on Windows. And IBM took a version of OpenOffice and branded it in their Lotus suite. I forget what it was called, Lotus Symphony, that's what it was called. Symphony, OpenOffice, LibreOffice, they all do the same thing. When you're using one or the other, you'll notice a few little differences, but pretty much from an average person's perspective, they're the same. Technically they're different, but they're the same.
So stick with one,
Pick what you like and use it. I think LibreOffice has the best chance of having the latest cutting-edge features.
Okay.
OpenOffice is starting to develop cutting-edge features of its own again. Mm-hmm.
I remember that Office, we were saying OpenOffice is going to go bye-bye, and that LibreOffice is taking its place, and evidently that's not what's happening then.
Yeah, primarily because Oracle moved it over to Apache. Mm-hmm. So they I don't know whether they sold it or gave it or right. whatever, but they Apache is driving it now. So it's definitely underway again from a heavy development perspective. I had no faith that Oracle was going to do much of anything good with it.
Okay. All right. We have time for Chris's email. Yeah.
Probably do.
Okay.
So Chris in St. Louis knows the answer to a question posed last month about VirtualBox on the Going Linux podcast. In fact, it may have been posed right here on the Computer America show on one of these shows. He says, hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. I've been listening to your show and others for several years. You guys do a fantastic job of helping people and giving people relevant information. Even though I've been running Linux since around 1994, Linux was released its very first version in 1992, so he's an early adopter for sure. I still find myself learning something from your podcast. Anyway, I feel the urge to contact you regarding John's question regarding VirtualBox, as it seems there is some confusion regarding this.
And I guess we'll pick it up on the other side of this break. Okay, we'll continue.
Sounds good to me.
This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. We'll continue on with Chris's email. It's our All Linux Show. We'll be right back. Larry Bushy continues on with us as we're winding down our two-hour Linux show. A lot of information has been given out, and again, if you missed any of it, you can read all the links in our show notes button right there at ComputerAmerica.com on our homepage. Just on the top there, it says show notes. You can get all the links. So we're right that we're reading Chris in St. Louis wrote to you, Larry, Tom, and Bill, and why don't you continue on, Larry?
Sure. So Chris is talking about VirtualBox extensions, which came up in one of our podcast episodes. So the VirtualBox extensions are simply drivers. They are drivers for the virtual hardware that VirtualBox presents to the guest operating system to run on. Mm-hmm. A lot of the hardware that it emulates is fairly standard, which is why it will run without extensions, but they are optimized for the VirtualBox hardware. This allows for things such as USB pass-through, mouse integration, better video resolution and performance, with the ability to resize the screens, etc. These extensions need to be installed in each of the virtual machines, as they are completely independent machines, each with their own operating system. Also, when you get newer versions of VirtualBox, you should update the guest extensions as they do change and improve them. If you have lots of virtual machines, it can be a pain to update them all, but it beats having the equivalent amount of physical hardware, etc., to deal with and power. Anyway, keep up the awesome work. Chris from St. Louis. And I also have to say that Inet Can, who's in the chat room, provided information about this on our forum and essentially said very similar sorts of things and clarified the whole topic. So thanks, Ken, for that.
If you have a lot of virtual machines, don't they have? You think they'd have a utility called, Virtual All or Virtual Master? So you make a change there, it makes all the changes in all the virtual machines at the same time.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah,
we should talk to Oracle about.
Yeah, that. Have somebody clever come up with that.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Oh boy. Again, and that's from Chris in St. Louis. So that
yes,
and that winds up most of our email. Tell us a little about the Going Linux podcast and what's coming up next.
Sure. So the Going Linux podcast comes out three times a month. We start off the month with a listener feedback episode where the three co-hosts read listener email, much as we've done here, and answer the questions not quite live, but on the air, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the second episode of the month is either a Computer America episode or a listener experience episode, depending on when the third Tuesday of the month lands. So we rebroadcast the Computer America episodes on our podcast, so you have your choice of listening to them here on Computer America or on our show, or mm-hmm. both. Mm-hmm. You can do both. And then the listener experience episode, we take a topic, and for the first month, we go kind of light on it, introduce the topic, and mm-hmm. the second month, we go into a little more depth, typically. And our next listener experience episode is actually an interview with Canonical's John O'Bacon, who is the community manager for the Ubuntu Linux distribution. So Bill, one of our co-hosts, did an interview with John O, and it's actually on our website right now.
Wow. Okay. And when is the next Going Linux podcast? When is it scheduled?
Well, as soon as I get the feed and the files from Computer America, I'll edit those down and put them on. So that'll be in the next couple of days.
All right.
And then we will have a listener feedback episode on the 5th of July. That will be our next episode after that.
Yeah, because the 4th.
Do we get royalties for that?
No.
Perfect. Okay, just making sure.
Just making sure that the compensation for that is about equivalent to your salary.
Salary, I guess. Yeah, it's right up there with that. Exactly. Oh boy. Exactly. And again, of course, you can listen to any Going Linux podcast right from the very, very first one. You know, you got them all.
Yeah, we have all of our episodes back to episode one right on our website, so you can play them on the show notes page. We have a Flash player there for those of you who like Flash, mm-hmm. or if your browser supports it, an HTML5 player, mm-hmm. and you can listen to them there. You can download the episodes from the website. You mm-hmm. can subscribe to our RSS feed mm-hmm. in your podcatching software. You can get us on iTunes.
Yeah.
You can email us your questions at goinglinux@gmail.com. Lots of places to get a hold of us and listen to our podcast if you want to.
And you also go to our links page at computeramerica.com. We have a link there.
Yes, thank you for that.
Hey, Larry, listen, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us here tonight. It was always a pleasure here, and obviously we will see you next month on our next Going Linux, our next Linux show in July. And again, for those of you who don't have the list, remember, just get on our buddy list, and you'll get our weekly email newsletter, the show reminder, and that tells you the schedule for that week. It's available nowhere else in the universe except in our show reminder, and you can get that. Just head over to our buddy list, sign up, and also every Friday from that list of names, we draw a winning name to win a really nice prize from over at Logitech as well. So, again, thanks so much for being with us here tonight, Larry. We'll see you next month, okay?
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Have a good evening. Good night.
Music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.